Hello again, welcome back. This is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid and the Web Yeshiva with another installment in our series on Rabbi Soloveitchik's Lonely Man of Faith. Last week we had an introduction, generally speaking, to Rabbi Soloveitchik, to his biography, to his school of philosophy. And this week we will roll up our sleeves and get into the study of a good chunk, hopefully, of the first chapter of The Lonely Man of Faith. Let me just take a look who's online with us. Okay. The Lonely Man of Faith, I think I mentioned this last week, is a particularly important essay in understanding Rabbi Soloveitchik's religious philosophy. For a number of reasons, principally because of its content, as we will discover as we move along, but also because it was penned by him, as opposed to many of his other writings, which were either transcripts of talks that he gave, or this series of posthumously published books, etc. But this essay was originally published as a long essay in the journal Tradition. Tradition is a quarterly journal that's published four times a year by the Rabbinic Council of America, which is an organization in the United States in which Rabbi Soloveitchik was very involved. During his lifetime, the journal still exists. I have the privilege of currently serving on the editorial board of that journal. I put a link to their website up in the chat. I see Alan also did as well. And this essay, The Lonely Man of Faith, was a very long essay that appeared in an issue published in 1965, and it was written by Rabbi Soloveitchik in English for publication. It was subsequently translated from English into Hebrew and into other languages as well. So it's important also in that sense that it was something that was authored by him for publication. An interesting little anecdotal footnote to the whole thing. Our own teacher and Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Chaim Bravender, was at the time in 1965, I think what was called the editorial assistant. It's a position that we still have in the journal. Usually it's staffed by a young rabbinical student, often at Yeshiva University. And when Rabbi Bravender was given that job, he was given one task and one task only to accomplish throughout that year. The editor of the journal at the time was Rabbi Walter Wurzberger, Zichrono Lebracha, and he told the young Rabbi Bravender, not yet Rabbi Bravender, that Rabbi Soloveitchik had promised to write an important essay and hadn't yet got around to doing it, and it was Rabbi Bravender's job to get this manuscript from the Rav. So he apparently spent the year sheepishly trying to bother the Rav about this. The Rav was never too welcome to being annoyed about these types of things. And the way he tells the story that, you know, on the last possible day, as the elevator doors were closing and the Rav was leaving the building, he thrust a manila envelope with the manuscript in it. He quickly took it to his dorm room, where he opened it up and was the first person to read The Lonely Man of Faith. And it was published in the summer 1965 issue of Tradition as a Long Essay, and then again it was subsequently published in book form, first by Doubleday, by Random House, by Aronson. They're all photo offsets of the same edition. And you have a PDF version of one of those, which has been made available with copyright permissions through the website of Tradition. Rabbi Soloveitchik authored a number of other important essays in English that were published in tradition. One of them I'll make reference to as we move along tonight. It's also important to note that although he authored the essay, it wasn't merely a talk that he gave, a lecture that he gave, that the transcript was written up. It was based on a series of lectures that he gave at the National Institute for Mental Health. I don't know, I assume that it is known, I don't know the circumstances by which he was invited to give this series of lectures, but that's not insignificant, that The Lonely Man of Faith was formulated as a series of lectures delivered to a not-Jewish crowd, or a not-specifically Jewish crowd. And you'll notice one of the very distinct things about it is the universalistic message of the work. He's not talking about Judaism per se. He's talking about the nature of religious life. Since he is Rabbi Soloveitchik, the examples that he gives, the sources on which he's drawing, are from within the Jewish tradition, but the prime text on which he's working is chapter 1 and chapter 2 of the book of Genesis, which is, of course, a pretty universal religious text, although a religious Jew will approach it with his own set of understandings and faith assumptions. But the work itself is a very universalistic text. While we're making some initial station identification announcements of these natures, it's important to note, of course, that when he talks about the man of faith, he was using the conventional gendered language of the 1960s. Everything... everything that's said about the man of faith is true also of the woman of faith, and I don't think that it will be too difficult to make those assumptions, but I think it would be a little cumbersome to try to translate every gendered reference that he makes in this essay to gender-neutral language, so I won't attempt that. Let me just pause. Ezra, are you there? Ezra, are you there? I'm having some sound trouble. I mean, can you hear me? Okay, so perhaps it's solved. Okay. So again, you know, just by way of disclaimer, about the nature of the gendered language. Okay. Fine. Okay, let's just roll up our sleeves and get into it. Here we go. This is the short preface. He starts off by saying, it's not the plan of this essay to discuss the millennium-old problem of faith and reason. This essay is not about the challenge of science, the challenge of reason to religion. That's not what this is about. And many people, myself included, I described it in that little essay that I sent you, or that I linked to, where I described my own first encounter with this work many years ago. Many people see a work with the felicitous title, The Lonely Man of Faith, and assume it's some kind of guide to the perplexed about proving that there's a God, or making an argument for faith, or trying to explain why the righteous suffer, or any of the other myriad problems that people have, many of the other questions that people have. That's not what this book is about. Theory is not my concern at the moment. I want instead to focus attention on a human life situation in which the man of faith, as an individual concrete being, with his cares and hopes, concerns and needs, joys and sad moments, is entangled. It's an essay about the religious experience. It is focused almost exclusively on the practitioner of faith, on the believer, on the religious person himself. It is not a theological essay in the manner in which that term is normally understood. Therefore, whatever I'm going to say here has been derived not from philosophical dialectics, abstract speculation, or detached impersonal reflections, but from actual situations and experiences with which I have been confronted. In other words, this is a very personal description. It's a personal dissection of his own inner religious life, personality, psychology, and identity. He'll go on to stipulate that it's relevant, it's a description of his own inner life. It may or may not resonate with your religious inner life. And he explains why he feels that there's benefit in doing this. I have no problem-solving thoughts. I do not intend to suggest a new method of remedying the human situation, which I'm about to describe. Meaning, he knows he's describing a reality that's fraught with tension, fraught with problems. Again, remember the text that we studied last time. Could you please hold it down? Remember the text that we saw last time, the famous fourth footnote to The Lonely Man of Faith. He says, I'm not trying to solve anybody's problems. I am going to engage in a descriptive act. Neither do I believe that it can be remedied at all. The reason that I'm not going to give you simple solutions is because there are no simple solutions. It's a problem, it's a tension, which is fraught, which is built in to religious life. It's not something that we can ameliorate. The role of the man of faith, whose religious experience is fraught with inner conflicts and incongruities, has been a difficult one, I'm skipping ahead, since the times of Abraham and Moses. This is built in to the religious system. It would be presumptuous of me to attempt to convert the passional here means suffering. You may remember there was a film a few years ago about a different faith tradition that had the word passion in the title. Passion doesn't mean passion like romance. Passion means suffering. So that movie was about the suffering of Jesus. So I'm not interested in trying to convert the passional, antinomic faith experience. Antinomic means self-contradictory, fraught with contradiction, into a eudaimonic, harmonious one. Eudaimonic means to produce pleasure. So he says, I'm not interested in relieving you of the suffering, of the contradictions, of the maelstrom of the fourth footnote, and trying to convert it into greener pastures and harmony and happiness and pleasure. While the biblical knights of faith lived heroically with this very tragic and paradoxical experience. If Abraham and Moses experienced religion as one that was fraught with tension, so why would I, even if I had a magic wand, want to relieve you of that? Tension is okay. Contradiction is okay. Conflict is okay. Not if it stifles us, not if it paralyzes us. But out of the contradiction, out of the struggle, we can emerge exalted and renewed. And that's the Knights of Faith. That's the description. That expression, the Knights of Faith, not knight meaning the opposite of day, but knight, the champions of faith. This is an expression that the Rav is borrowing from Kierkegaard. Søren Kierkegaard, the great 19th century existentialist philosopher and writer and author, who is among a stable of general writers and philosophers and thinkers that were of influence on Rabbi Soloveitchik. We'll come back to him again, perhaps even already tonight. But if you're unfamiliar with Kierkegaard, a visit to Wikipedia or the Encyclopedia Britannica, if anybody still has one on a shelf, is a worthwhile use of a few minutes of time. Pardon me. I must apologize for my hoarse voice that you are all have to suffer with. Now, the beginning of chapter 1. The nature of this dilemma. He's told you there's a dilemma. I can't solve the dilemma. The dilemma is built in into the system. The dilemma can be summarized in a 3-word sentence. I am lonely. I am lonely, he says. And again, he's admitted to us that this is a personal description of his own life. It either does or does not resonate with you. Let me emphasize, however, that by stating I am lonely, I do not intend to convey to you the impression that I am alone. This is an important first. This is an important first fact to establish. Loneliness does not mean that you are alone. I, thank God, do enjoy the love and friendship of many. I meet people, talk, preach, argue, reason. I'm surrounded by comrades and acquaintances. And yet companionship and friendship do not alleviate the passional, again, the suffering experience of loneliness, which trails me constantly. I am lonely because at times I feel rejected and thrust away by everybody, not excluding my most intimate friends, and the words of the psalmist, the words of David HaMelech and Tehillim, Ki avi ve'imi ya'azvuni, my mother and father, even my mother and father have forsaken me, ring quite true in my ears, like the plaintive cooing of the turtle dove. The Rav definitely had a poetic component to him, the plaintive cooing of the turtle dove. It is a strange, alas, absurd experience, engendering sharp, enervating pain as well as stimulating cathartic feeling. I despair because I am lonely and hence feel frustrated. On the other hand, I also feel invigorated because this very experience of loneliness presses everything in me into the service of God. How does that work? To be lonely means to be aware of your uniqueness. It's one of our essential beliefs that each and every person is unique. That actually is the foundation for one of Maimonides' philosophical notions of how hashkacha, how divine providence works. The Rambam is of the opinion that individuals are the beneficiaries of God's unique, divine, individual providence, that he takes note of each and every one of us. However, that is not true for other species. Animals, for example, are not entitled to hashkacha pratit, to individual, divine supervision, but rather God is concerned with each species. He doesn't care about Bessie the cow. He cares about cows as a species. That's why, according to the Rambam, I mean, according to the Gemara, but the Rambam codifies it as well, that if a person dies, it's like the extinction of an entire world. Or the converse, if you save someone's life, it's as if you established it, it's as if you preserved an entire world. It's the equivalent, the death of a person is equivalent to the extinction of an entire species because of the uniqueness of each and every human being. To be alone is to be aware of your uniqueness. And when you're aware of your uniqueness, that causes a sense of isolation. And it is also the basis on which an individual is or feels him or herself to be misunderstood by people. Everyone knows if they're healthy, that is, if they have a healthy self-image and self-awareness, they're aware of who they really are. We're not always aware of how we're perceived by others. If we're lucky, we can have a good sense of that. But each of us, at different times in our life, must feel misunderstood, that other people don't really get us. They don't really know what's going on under the surface, what we really feel, what we really believe, what we really think, how we interpret the world, the kind of the glasses through which we take everything in. If we're lucky, we encounter people that really do understand us. Often that's in the context of marriage, and that topic is something we'll come back to in this work. But that sense that there's another person out there, that's real communion. Communion in the sense that there's someone with whom I can really communicate, even beyond the bounds of language. But that aside, in most cases, with our extended family, with our coworkers, with acquaintances, with the person that sits next to us on the bus or in shul or wherever it is, there's a block. We can only ever really know each other to a certain degree. And that sense, that loneliness, that isolation that comes from the awareness that we are unique, leads to a sense of being incommunicado, out of touch, blocked, that the communication isn't working the way we might want it to. But that's okay. Because we're lonely, we are lonely, but there's another being, another entity which is lonely, and that's the lonely one with a capital L and a capital O. That God himself, who is, I know that the linguists will tell us, you know, that the word unique can't take a modifier, but still, that God is the most unique one. That's what Echad is. Hashem Echad, that literally unique, uni, one. That he is lonely, he is alone, no other likened unto him. And that also means that we're separated from him. It also means that, hard as we try, we can never fully understand him. That's okay. It justifies, it sanctions our own sense of loneliness. I must address myself to the obvious question. Why am I beset by this feeling of loneliness and being unwanted? Is it the Kierkegaardian anguish? Again, here's Kierkegaard. An ontological fear nurtured by the awareness of non-being threatening one's existence that assails me? Ontological, let me make two points. Ontological is this, ontology is the study of being. The study of being. And as a side point, we should note that the Rav had a rather rich vocabulary. Eudaimic, ontology, what are some of the other words that we've encountered? Passional. This just in the first two pages. The Rav had a rich vocabulary which he intentionally marshaled to the purposes of lending dignity to his writing, particularly at a time when Orthodox rabbis in the United States were not known for writing this way. He was trying to, I mean, part of it was this was his style. This was the style that he chose for himself. But one senses that there was an agenda at work in writing in this way. It may or may not now, almost 50 years later, create some distance or division with contemporary readers. Because of the vocabulary in the work, in this work, in the Ish Halacha and other essays, there's this impression that it's very hard to read Rabbi Soloveitchik. This is not true. I don't believe that to be true. It's not a page-turner. It's not the kind of thing you can, you know, read breezily on the subway during your commute. You need access to a dictionary. But that doesn't, in and of itself, make the concepts impossible to understand. That's an important note, and it's important to distill that misunderstanding of what the encounter with Rabbi Soloveitchik's writing is about. It is meant to be understood. It is eminently understandable. That doesn't mean the ideas are easy. You have to think about them. You have to wrestle with them. But at the level of understanding what he's saying, with work, a little bit of work, it can easily be accomplished by a person of average intelligence who's prepared to do the work. His audience was a popular audience. This was a popular work. Popular meaning it was meant for a general audience, not for specialists, not for philosophers or theologians or rabbis. So I'm beset by this feeling of loneliness and being unwanted. But why am I beset by this feeling of loneliness and being unwanted? Is it perhaps the result of the pervasive state of mind of Western man who has become estranged from himself, a state with which all of us Westerners are acquainted? I believe that even though all of these explanations might be true to some extent, and genuine and central cause of the feeling of loneliness from which I cannot free myself is to be found in a different dimension. That's true, what I said earlier, but the real source of my loneliness is something else. It is in the experience of faith itself. It is, again, built into the nature of religion. I am lonely because in my humble, inadequate way, I am a man of faith for whom to be means to believe, and who substituted credo for cogito in the time-honored Cartesian maxim. Descartes, Cartesian is the adjective that applies to the thought of Descartes. Descartes famously said, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And Rabbi Soloveitchik says, I have substituted credo, creed, I believe, therefore I am. The definition of who I am as a religious person is my belief, first and foremost. Rabbi Soloveitchik, a great Maimonidean, was, of course, a rationalist. He did not disparage thought and thinking, cogito, cognition. But first and foremost, we are people of creed. We are people of belief. I'm going to skip ahead to page 6. Again, I'll just point out something I wrote in the email. When I make references to page numbers, they correspond, you see, at the top of each page in the PDF we're working with is a page number, which doesn't necessarily correspond to the page in the PDF itself. So when I say you should read from page X to page Y, it refers not to the page in the PDF, but in the work itself. So this is page 6. Let me spell out this passional experience of contemporary men of faith. Let me explain why the contemporary person suffers from this dilemma. The contemporary person of faith looks upon himself as a stranger in modern society, which is technically minded, self-centered, self-loving, almost in a sickly narcissistic fashion, scoring honor upon honor, piling up victory upon victory, reaching for the distant galaxies, and seeing in the here and now sensible world the only manifestation of being. Again, this is written in the mid-60s. It's the height of the space race. Later, he'll have something positive to say about that. But there's something alienating about modern society, about modern technology. And if it was true in the 1960s, alachas kama v'kama, in the world of beeps and Twitters. What can a man of faith like myself, living by a doctrine which has no technical potential, by a law which cannot be tested in the laboratory, steadfast in his loyalty to an eschatological vision, eschatology, Yemot HaMashiach, the end of days, a vision of the destiny of the world, steadfast in his loyalty to an eschatological vision, Yemot HaMashiach, the Messianic era, whose fulfillment cannot be predicted with any degree of probability scientifically, let alone certainty, even by the most complex advanced mathematical calculations. I live by a world of faith, which is independent of, which is autonomous, and can't be tested and held up to the scrutiny of the scientific standards, which are the coin of the realm. What can such a man say to a functional utilitarian society, which is seculum-oriented, olam hazeh, this world-oriented, and whose practical reasons of the mind have long ago supplanted the sensitive reasons of the heart? But how can I, as a man of faith, as a man of the heart, as a man of the credo, as a man of belief, what is my answer to the world around me? A technological society, a utilitarian society, a society that measures things by pragmatic standards, not by spiritual standards, a society that tests everything by a type of scientific yardstick. I can't measure. It's apples and oranges. We're talking different languages. Now, to be clear, he's not criticizing the general culture. He's not saying that it's inherently bad. He's just saying it's a
It's on a completely different wavelength. And you can't measure one by the other. This is a theme that runs throughout his thought and writings. The autonomous integrity of the religious system in general universal terms, or the halachic system in more specific Jewish terms, is an autonomous system with its own integrity that has to be judged by its own internal code and its own internal logic and its own internal yardstick. And if you're going to try to judge it by the seculum, by the olam hazeh, by the this-worldly, scientific, pragmatic society, you're doing a disservice to both. Because these are two different systems. It would be worthwhile to add the following in order to place the dilemma in the proper focus. And now he says something remarkable. He points to four different items, an inventory of crises of faith, which he says that he has never been seriously troubled by. What are these four? The first is creation versus evolution. The second, he's never been perturbed by the confrontation of the mechanistic interpretation of the human mind with the biblical spiritual concept of man. The first is Darwin, the second is Freud. The first is science versus religion. The second is the undermining of religion by what was then contemporary psychology, psychiatry. I have not been perplexed by the impossibility of fitting the mystery of revelation into the framework of historical empiricism. Hitgalut, revelation, a core belief that God revealed his will to man through the Torah. And moreover, I have not been troubled by the theories of biblical criticism. This fourth one will become significant because he is now going to engage in an act of he is now going to engage in an act of biblical interpretation, which bears certain resemblance to the type of analyses that most people think of as biblical criticism. Now, biblical criticism, among other things, was interested in the so-called documentary hypothesis that put forth the notion that the Bible was a hodgepodge, a collection of different documents that were edited together. And because of that, there are going to be overlaps and gaps. So, for example, the first two chapters of Genesis are, they will posit, two independent narratives describing the creation of the world, told or written by two different authors that the editor of the Bible, the compiler of the Bible, put together. And therefore, there are contradictions between the two. Now, this idea, and whenever you have any kind of repetition, or often when you have a type of repetition in the Bible, the biblical critics, the documentary hypothesizers, will point and say this was written by one set of authors, and that was written by a different set of authors, and that can explain the differences between the two different versions. Ad kan, the theories of biblical criticism. I've oversimplified it, to be sure. Chazal, the sages, in the Medrash, in the Talmud, the Gemara, were also aware of these types of repetitions. But approaching them, as Rabbi Soloveitchik himself does, from a faith commitment that the Torah is the product of divine revelation, given to Moses at Sinai, they approach these apparent contradictions from a different starting point. And Rabbi Soloveitchik will now engage in an act of interpretation. His point here is not actually to do biblical interpretation. He's using the opening chapters of Breshit as a raw material from which to build his thesis about the dual nature of mankind. He's not in so much as doing Parshanut HaMikra, trying to do a type of exposition of the text per se, although in the process there's quite a good deal of that going on. This question of biblical criticism, which contradicts the very foundations upon which the sanctity and integrity of the scriptures rest. However, while theoretical oppositions and dichotomies have never tormented my thoughts, I could not shake off the disquieting feeling that the practical role of the man of faith within modern society is a very difficult, indeed, a paradoxical one. So he says, when people think of crises of faith, they'll give you a menu of things. Science and religion. Can we really believe in revelation? Evolution. Biblical criticism. This is the smorgasbord of crises of faith that people experience, that questions that people of faith wrestle with. Hopefully they come out on top of the crisis. Sometimes they're quashed by it. But he says, these are not my problems. My problems are not my challenges. The challenges that I face are not in questions from the outside, but with the inherent nature of the religious life itself. But again, the religious life as I define it, the religious life as I experience it, not the religious life of contemporary American religion, mid-20th century religion, which is, again, still waters, green pastures, the family that prays together stays together. Religion is some kind of panacea to all of the social ills. This, again, is an idea very foreign to his thought. The purpose of this essay, then, is to define the great dilemma confronting contemporary man of faith. This probably should be contemporary men of faith. That may be a typo. And then before he gets into the Adam 1 and Adam 2, he adds one more disclaimer here on page 9. Before beginning the analysis, we must determine within which frame of reference psychological and psychological and empirical, or theological and biblical, our dilemma should be described. I believe you will agree with me I'm going to skip ahead even further. Before I go any further, I want to make the following reservation. Whatever I'm about to say is to be seen only as a modest attempt on the part of a man of faith to interpret his spiritual perceptions and emotions in modern theological and philosophical categories. My interpretive gesture is completely subjective and lays no claim to representing a definitive halachic philosophy, Jewish philosophy. If my audience will feel these interpretations are also relevant to their perceptions and emotions, I shall feel amply rewarded. However, I shall not feel hurt if my thoughts will find no resonance in the hearts of my listeners. Again, this is a personal
This is a personal, this is a personal statement, personal description. Let me just pause here and look at some of these chats. Pesach listed something here that this was, that the lectures on which it was based were undertaken in 1960. There was this joint project with Yeshiva University's Institute of Mental Health, with Harvard and Loyola, which was a study of religious attitudes to psychological problems. I think that that is correct. My memory is that that is correct. He now gets into his description of the first two accounts of the creation of man. Now, this is interesting. Like I mentioned in that, I don't know if you've had a chance to read that little essay of mine. When I encountered this, this essay in high school, I was a public school student in growing up in New Jersey. Hold on a second, let me call this up. Here you go. I'm posting a link to this essay where I describe how I discovered the Lonely Man of Faith, which back then it was hard to come by because it had not been republished in book form, and you had to get a Xerox of a Xerox of the original journal essay. It had never occurred to me that the story of creation is told twice, and not just told twice, but told with various contradictions or nuances of difference between them. But I was a public high school kid. I've encountered many other people who, when they first meet the Lonely Man of Faith, had been studying, you know, in yeshiva and had sat in shul on Parshat Bereishit many, 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 many times. And they had also never considered what it meant that the story of creation is told first in Bereishit chapter 1 and then again in chapter 2. The Rav lists four essential differences. I had asked you to look through the two stories of creation. The Rav lists four essential differences between the two accounts of creation. And with them, he develops this idea of two unique personalities, two human ideals, what he calls Adam 1 and Adam 2, or Adam the first and Adam the second. That which is a distillation of the narrative in the first chapter of Genesis versus that as it comes out from the second chapter of Genesis. The attempt to embody both typologies, both ideals, is the source of the tension. That the loneliness that we feel is a function of being caught between both types and not being fully at home in either. For next week, we're not done yet, but for next week, finish reading the first chapter well. But let's just highlight these differences between the first and the second chapter of Bereishit. First of all, this is not the order in which he describes it. In the first chapter of Bereishit, God is described as Elohim. In the second chapter, he's described as Hashem Elohim, Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, what he calls in Greek the tetragrammation, the four-letter name, Yud, He, Vav, and He, in this database that I pulled the verses from, the psukim from, they substitute the He's with the letter Kuf, because that name as spelled out, God's holy name, Yud, He, Vav, and He, is not something that we normally just write out. In the first chapter, man is described as being created B'Tselem Elohim, in God's holy image. In the second chapter, he's described as being created Afar Min Ha'adama, dust of the earth, in which we are formed, and then which God literally blows the living soul into. The first is quite majestic. Tselem Elohim. We're created in God's holy image. The second chapter, we're, you know, like the leftovers. We're made of the spare parts. In the first chapter, mankind is created Zacharu Nekeva Bara Otam. Male and female created apparently simultaneously. In the second chapter, and if you know the Rashi and the Midrash on this Pasuk, you understand what drove Chazal to say that, to say what they say. In the second chapter, man is created, and then God declares, Lo tov heyot adam levado. It's not good for man to be alone. It's not good for Adam to be alone. And therefore, eselo ezer kenegdo. And therefore, we will subsequently have to create a wife for him. We'll have to create Chava. We'll have to make Eve. In the first chapter, mankind is commanded, Pru urvu meluata aretz, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, vikiv shuha, and conquer it. In the second chapter, command to man is La'avda u'leshamra, to guard and work, to maintain the Garden of Eden. And these are four very essential differences between the two accounts of creation. And if we were to try to understand, if we were to distill what each account is telling us, as Rabbi Soloveitchik will do, we would be pointed to two very different visions of who man is, of what mankind is, and what his task in the world is. And unlike the biblical critics, we'll say, well, this chapter was written by so-and-so, and that chapter was written by somebody else, and a third person came along and edited them together into one book. Rabbi Soloveitchik, of course, is committed to the idea that both these and those are the words of the living God, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim Chaim, they are two reflections on, they are two reflections on the reality. That man is both this and that. And that the struggle between these two, the dichotomy, the duality between chapter 1 and chapter 2 is the definition of who we are and what we are. And working out that struggle is the task of the religious life. So finish reading chapter 1 for next week. We've unpacked a little bit the texts on which the rest of the chapter rests, and we'll continue there. There's another work I mentioned earlier. There's a short essay called Majesty and Humility. It's actually a later essay, written just a couple of years later, a shorter essay, a bit of an easier essay, where he often would do this. He would revisit a theme in different ways. But majesty and humility, these two different
these two different poles, the majesty of chapter one, the humility of chapter two. That essay is an important complement to The Lonely Man of Faith. I'll post it to the Sheer homepage. I don't think that we'll read it or learn it together, but if anybody's interested in reading that essay in addition, it's an important complement to the Lonely Man of Faith. So I'll send that out to you as well, and we'll continue next week. And again, my apologies for having to listen to me croak and cough and choke over the past hour or so. I will stay online if anybody has any questions.